Welcome to Supersized Science, where we feature research and discoveries nationwide enabled by advanced computing technology and expertise at the Texas Advanced Computing Center of the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Jorge Salazar, a science writer at TAC. A new leaf has turned in scientists' hunt for developing cutting-edge materials used in organic light-emitting diode, OLED, TVs, touchscreens, and more. The advance involves the polaron, a quasi-particle consisting of an electron and its surrounding distortions of atoms in a crystal lattice. Simulations on the Texas Advanced Computing Center's Frontera supercomputer have helped scientists map, for the first time, the conditions that characterize polarons in two-dimensional materials, the thinnest materials that have ever been made. Understanding polarons can help the performance and efficiency of devices such as touchscreens for phones and tablets, and the organic light-emitting diodes of OLED TVs, which rely on electric charge transport through polarons. What's more, generating hydrogen fuel from the splitting of water by sunlight is considered the holy grail of energy science, a process which can be achieved through charge transport from polarons in key materials such as titanium dioxide. On the podcast today is Feliciano Giustino, professor of physics and the W.A. Tech's Moncrief Jr. Chair of Quantum Materials Engineering at the Odin Institute for Computational Engineering and Sciences, and the Department of Physics, College of Natural Sciences, the University of Texas at Austin. Giustino is the lead author on polaron research, published February 2023 in Nature Physics. In it, he and study co-author Weng Hong Seo of the Odin Institute and the University of Macau determined the fundamental properties of polarons in two-dimensional materials using quantum mechanical theory and computation. Dr. Giustino, welcome to the podcast.
Can you speak more about the main findings here?
So basically, the first thing is that there is, well, as you know, there is a huge interest in 2D materials. So these are materials that consist essentially of a single atomic layer, the thinnest materials that, you know, have ever been made. And they are studied, you know, by hundreds or thousands of groups because they are a bit the hope of future electronics. Transistors today, which are the key elements of electronic circuits, are going down to the nanoscale. So they are the order, I think, of maybe 5 or 6 nanometers. A nanometer is, you know, 1/1,000,000th of a meter. And future scaling beyond this level will require to go at the atomic scale. And this is will be possible using two-dimensional materials, essentially. So the most famous two-dimensional material is graphene. I'm sure that you heard of it. Is this one-dimensional layer of carbon atoms. That was the beginning of 2D materials research. But now there are many, many more, essentially. So many groups found new materials. So there are many questions on what are the properties of these materials. So one of the key properties for the applications is how electricity, basically, so how electric currents are transported through these materials, okay? For example, the basic function of a transistor is to have a on or off current depending on the applied voltage. And that is dependent on how an electron, so the carrier or charge in this material, responds to an applied electric field. Okay, so this is the fundamental property of all these materials, and understanding how charge moves under the action of an applied field is the key design question for anybody wanting to develop 2D kind of electronics, photonics, you know, energy materials and whatnot. In two-dimensional crystals, meaning materials where the atoms are arranged in periodic patterns, what we learn in, you know, as undergrads is that electrons form waves, okay? Meaning that, so in quantum mechanics, particles are actually waves, and these waves are like really behaving as water wave or sound waves, okay? The main characteristic of a wave is that it's delocalized over the size of the entire material, essentially. So that's a key property of quantum mechanical objects. What we studied in this work is something called the polaron, which is an electron slightly modified by the fact that it interacts with the atomic lattice. That means that the electron lives in a lattice where there are atoms, And this interaction, because, you know, the electron is charged negatively and the atom and nuclei are positive, there is a Coulomb interaction, basically, that makes the atoms attracted to this negative charge of the electron. So this is very standard. It happens in every material. And that essentially slightly modifies the property of the electrons, okay? So maybe it makes it go a little bit slower, or it makes it, you know, it endows it with some properties that are interesting to study and they are important for applications. Now, something interesting happens when the interaction between the electron and these atoms is so strong that basically the electron pulls the atoms around itself. So this creates a concentration of positive charge that actually attracts the electron in turn. So when this feedback mechanism is strong, what happens is that the electron forms essentially a packet together with the atoms distorted around himself. And this object is what is called a polaron. So the way to imagine it is like in these pictures, for example, where you know you have an elastic sheet or something, and you put maybe a marble or you know a heavy sphere in the middle, so that distorts. It creates kind of a dip, right? Like in gravitation plots, things like that. So this distortion actually creates an environment around the electron that is modified by its presence. And that endows the electron with completely new properties. So I'm going to say it in a better way, but the key thing is that the electron, instead of being a delocalized wave, becomes a localized wave packet. It's like a little kind of wave packet that actually now has the properties of a particle more than a wave. And the consequence is that the way it moves around the lattice is no longer the same as a wave, but essentially has to jump between a lattice site and another one. So this is called hopping transport, essentially. And this is a different transport regime that you know people try to understand, because it has implications on the design of materials for electronics, essentially. So from the point of view of condensed matter physics and fundamental physics, essentially the polaron is a new particle that emerges from the interaction between electrons and the surrounding lattice. And this particle has new properties. So what we want to do in this study is to understand polarons in two-dimensional materials. So there's a lot of work that's been done over the past 100 years on polarons in three-dimensional materials, but pretty much nothing was known about what they do when you go to two dimensions. What we found essentially by using theory and computation is that while they exist under certain conditions in every three-dimensional material, they don't always exist in 2D. Essentially, only certain materials can host this kind of particles. Essentially, there is a critical condition that has to be satisfied for that to exist. And we believe that that explains why many experiments did not find this kind of particles in 2D. So what we charted is some kind of a map to indicate essentially in which materials they should be found and under which conditions and what would be their properties. The key links are 2D materials for electronics, photonics, and energy. And then the key element of all of these applications is the transport of electric charge. And then the transport of charge can happen either as waves, and that's the standard materials and standard conditions, or as polarons, which are these localized wave packets. Our aim was to understand whether one can find polarons in two dimensions and what are their properties, essentially. So that's the main novelty. And to do this, we used a new computational method that we developed, and we used supercomputers to perform the calculations. And among those, we used clearly Frontera attack.
You mentioned computational method that you developed. Is this the Quantum Espresso?
So Quantum Espresso is basically a large software distribution that is developed by probably a couple of dozen groups, actually. What we develop is a module of Quantum Espresso that is called EPW. That's a code that actually we invented and we developed. Now, actually, it's been developed by maybe 15 people around the world, and we are at UT Austin. We are basically leading the effort. It's a pretty large piece of code now. It's like 80,000 lines of Fortran and message passing interfaces. And it's something that we optimize very heavily on Frontera. In fact, during Texas scale days, we managed to perform full system runs, on the full 440,000 cores of Frontera when we were given the entire machine. So it's something that we've been essentially refactoring for exascale computing over the past 4 years now. And, you know, Frontera and TAC helped us with this effort. The other thing maybe one might want to mention is that with TAC, we do have a collaboration now within precisely within the LCCF. It's basically the CSA, one of the CSA projects. So this is a characteristic science allocation project, application project. So there are basically 20, I think 20 codes that have been selected to be benchmarked and optimized for the next computer. And, you know, EPW is this code that we develop is one of them, actually. So this effort is linked with the, you know, the CSA program. And the other thing we might want to mention, if you know, you feel like it, is that we have we do have a CSSI, basically an NSF grant called Cyber Infrastructure for Sustained Scientific Innovation. So it's one program of the NSF where Dan Stanzioni is our co-PI, meaning that basically it's four investigators. I'm the lead investigator, and Dan Stanzioni is one of the investigators. I mean, this is not directly related to this project, but I think, you know, it might be nice to mention that we have strong collaborations, you know, with TAC, at least on two fronts, you know, with the CSA, with the CSSI, on separate grants. I mean, this project is mostly sponsored by DOE, essentially. Frontera and TAC provided us with the opportunity to develop the codes on full-scale systems that has not been possible anywhere else, essentially.
Could you talk about the need for the supercomputers? What were the computational challenges?
So basically, these calculations correspond to a single layer of atoms, or, you know, double layer if the materials are two layers, something like that. Sometimes when I say small packets, you know, small is kind of a relative. For example, in the case of boron nitride that we studied in this, you know, in this manuscript, this packet extends over something of the order of maybe 10 nanometers. And that means that in terms of number of atoms, we're talking about something like 30,000 atoms. So that has boron and hydrogen atoms in extent. So actually, that kind of calculation it would not be possible using standard density functional theory methods. But for two reasons, it is too large. And basically, it needs some advanced called kind of features of density functional theory that are not available in standard code. So what we did is to kind of recast that equation, this problem, into the solution of a very large nonlinear eigenvalue problem. So basically a linear algebra problem, very large. And then we use the supercomputer to solve this gigantic linear algebra problem, essentially. That's the idea. You can imagine a very, very large you know, matrix diagonalization. And that requires essentially supercomputer resources because it has to be performed in parallel. It cannot be done on a single CPU. And it has to be performed on a very large number of nodes, essentially. So that's the main bottleneck. So bottom line, we want to study these particles on very large systems. And we reformulate this problem into a essentially matrix diagonalization problem on a, you know, very large scale. And that then is dealt with using a kind of standard kind of parallel linear algebra subroutines like scale-up-back and things like that that are available, you know, TAC and in other computers. So, and these usually we're talking about systems that are well beyond any kind of small-scale cluster. So they do require kind of high-performance computer resources.
What is the most important thing that you'd like the public to know about using supercomputers to understand new materials?
Let's put it this way. If we can do so today we can do a calculation of polarons with, you know, supercomputer like Frontera, that was simply impossible, you know, 10 years ago. And that gives us the ability to actually design new materials, you know, to optimize this kind of functionalities. And the number of potential new materials that exist is of the order of, you know, hundreds of millions. So the materials that we know today are a tiny fraction of what actually is possible. So supercomputers may be the key to explore this gigantic space without investing billions into experimental synthesis and characterization, but using computation to essentially give it a first pass and see what is possible and what will be out there before investing kind of hardcore, you know, resources for a kind of experimental research. And that's really the spirit of, I think, the Materials Genome Initiative that I'm sure you heard of. It's a, you know, US program to accelerate materials design discovery by computation. So essentially using computation as the first point of call to find new kind of opportunities in material science. And, you know, these things were simply impossible 10 years ago, and they have been made possible by the development of these large scale facilities. And actually, I'm a very strong advocate on continuing along this path and maintaining a US leadership in this space. So essentially, we will always need more and larger and better. And, you know, it is possible because the expertise is there. Teams like People at Tuck are, you know, phenomenal. And, you know, everybody benefits from those. It's better science. It's, you know, better engineering. And it also generates a lot of human capital and, you know, training of, you know, highly skilled, you know, professionals that will eventually go and populate the ranks of high-tech companies, you know, for, you know, tomorrow, essentially. So HPC, it's, I think, is the key to a lot of things. And, you know, whenever I'm actually, this is a kind of side story, but whenever I'm in committees, like evaluating some large programs and something like that, and there is mention of HPC, I make a point of making it clear to everybody that we should not stop this. It should go forward. We should keep being the leaders in this area because it's enabling so much science that, you know, would not be possible otherwise. I do hope that, you know, things like, you know, tech and will just keep growing and, you know, training people and helping people like us.
You've been listening to Feliciano Giustino of the Odin Institute at UT Austin. Supersized Science is part of the Texas Podcast Network. The conversation's changing the world, brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed on this podcast represent the views of the host, not of the University of Texas at Austin. For the Texas Advanced Computing Center, I'm Jorge Salazar.